As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Infinite complacence. People went to and fro the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
If you're on the hunt for another fantastic interview-based podcast to add into your rotation, look no further than Jim Harold's Campfire. His format is just like mine. He talks to everyday people who have experienced extraordinary things, without dramatic sound effects added in. Because these stories don't need it. He covers hauntings, UFOs, cryptids, and unclassifiable high strangeness. If that's not enough of a nudge, how about the fact that his shows have been downloaded over 60 million times, and that even just the campfire itself is in its 13th year? So do me a favor and follow Jim Harold's Campfire on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to Into the Fray. So on this edition of Into the Fray, I welcome back on with me Glenn Quiggins. This will be Kentucky Cave Mysteries Part 2. He is a professional musician, archaeologist, historian, and an ordained minister. He was on recently for episode 370, where we discussed experiences with Bigfoot, UFOs, occurrences of missing time, past lives, and more. And you're back on today to share even more. So welcome back on, Glenn. We've had quite the issues, is lightly putting it, as far as getting part two going. This is our second attempt at part two because it seems like someone or something doesn't want us to talk.
True. Well, thanks for having me back, and I'm glad that the ghost in the machine has left temporarily.
Like I mentioned in the intro, we talked about several different subjects, and people did enjoy your episode, and they were asking, when's Glenn coming back on? You mentioned part two, and he had more stories, so let's do this. So that's why we're back. And, you know, I have the list in front of me that you sent. If you'd like to just go down that list, should we kind of rock it that way and start with the ghosts in the cave? And I'm assuming this is the same cave that we've been talking about this entire time, right?
This is the same cave, yes. So this cave is a limestone cave,
and it's got quartz crystal veins running all the way through it. When you're sitting in the big cavern, you can just see giant veins of quartz running all the way through it. It's a great place to meditate because you're underground and it shields you from the EMFs, and you can really free your mind. So I went there with two of my friends, a Cherokee musician friend of mine and another artist. We were going to spend the day there. So they were hanging out in the main part of the cavern, and I walked back about 100 yards into the really dark part of the cave and sat down by the stream and lit a candle and was going to sit there and meditate. So I started meditating. I started hearing this Indian singing, like in Cherokee, a man singing, just really beautiful singing. And I noticed when he started singing, the candle flame almost went out. It dipped way down to where it almost went out. And then he stopped singing after about 15 seconds, and the candle went back to full flame. And I'm thinking, wow, my friend is out there singing. That's really beautiful. The singing starts up again, and the candle went very, very dim, almost out. And the singing continued for about another 20 seconds and stopped. And the candle went back to full flame. And this happened like two or three more times. I just sat there listening, like, this is really beautiful. I'm going to finish my meditation and go out there and, you know, with my friends and telling how nice I like that song, how much I like the song. So I'm walking back towards them in the main part of the cavern. And when I get about 20 yards from them and can see them, they start saying, "Hey, Glenn, wow, that sounded great. I didn't know you could sing like that." I'm like, "No, guys, I thought that was you singing." And they're like, "No, we thought it was you." So we all heard it. It was amazing. Just gives me chills right now just thinking about it.
Well, it's always nice to have other people there when things like that happen, because a lot of times you're solo and then you occasionally question yourself. I've been there, done that. So is this a one and done incident as far as the singing in the cave goes?
It was the only time we ever heard the Indian singing.
So next up, you have something here titled The Mother Goddess.
Yeah, so I was back at this same cave on a full moon camp, and I'd taken along a friend of mine that was visiting from Greece. He was in the middle of a family crisis and said he needed some spiritual healing, and he knew I practiced shamanism and meditation, and asked if he could come along, so he did. It gets dark. We're sitting around the campfire inside the cave, inside the big cavern, where the water flows through and then goes out and into this giant pool. And we're sitting there at the campfire, and we finished our food and we're having a hot cup of tea. He's telling me about his family problems and how it's weighing on his mind. And so I tell him, just try to meditate about it, go into it with the intention of finding a solution, and maybe something good will come from it. Because that's what I always do when I go into these meditations, as I usually have a question in my head or in my mind, or something I need to work through, or something I need the answer to. And that's traditionally been the way it has been with shamanism. Tens of thousands of years, if the tribe had a question, the shaman would go off and perform his ceremonies and come back with the answer usually. So that's been kind of my mindset the whole time. So we're sitting in the cave. I start my meditation. I'm doing some pranayama yoga. I start to levitate off the ground about a foot. And then I just leave my body. He said I just fell over backwards, left my body, and went into another dimension. I believe that, you know, a lot of the paranormal stuff is interdimensional things. For instance, according to string theory, there's 11 different dimensions. and you could be a millimeter apart from another dimension. It's kind of the experience I've had. So I was projected into this other dimension. As I entered it, I saw a huge dragon, and not like a medieval type European dragon, like the classic Chinese dragon. And it was doing the classic dragon dance. And when I was meditating, I had been using a mantra, the Om mantra. As I saw this dragon, and it was huge, it was probably 60 feet long. And it was doing the dragon dance, and it was making the Om sound. And it turned and looked right at me. The Om went up like an octave, and it terrified me. I was so scared. But I've learned that in these experiences, you've got to get through the fear. You've got to be able to work through that fear and not let it hold you down in order to get past it and experience whatever there is to experience. So I just left the fear behind and embraced it. And as I did, I was transported into the presence of this, I guess it was some kind of a ship. And inside the ship, there was a lot of other humans with me, and we were all in these little hexagonal cells, like in a giant beehive. And you could hear that dragon Om humming like a trillion bees. It was so loud, and you could just feel it all the way through you. And we were all in these little hexagons. We were transported into another dimension. And then all of a sudden, I was by myself, and it felt like I was just in the presence of Mother Earth, the Mother Goddess. And in Chinese mythology, that's what a dragon can symbolize, Mother Earth, and especially water and underground water. So I was in the presence of this Mother Goddess, and I just felt enveloped in this overwhelming sense of love, like all my senses were just filled with this unconditional love and just this feeling of safety. She told me she was the source of all creation. We needed to protect our creation. And I got this overwhelming sense of the destruction that is happening to our environment, and especially the water. And she told me that I was able to use my talents to help do something about it. And I came away with the realization that it's all in me, the ability to do these things. To the God energy is in all of us. And if we just tap into it, we can make things happen. And it's basically, I came back out of that, and I was back in the cave, and I was laying on my back. My Greek friend was really freaked out. He thought I had died for a few minutes. When I came back out of that experience, he said he was ready to go. He said he had meditated on it, and he loved his family, and he couldn't wait to get back to them. And he had so much respect for, his words, my Native American religion. And he said, the whole time I'm driving him home, he just kept saying, "You're unlimited. You're unlimited." Mm-hmm. And I took him back home, and that was the end of that experience.
So you were, quote unquote, gone for a few minutes. That's what your friend relayed to you. But when you're having all these different experiences, did it seem like you were gone for hours or days or maybe even longer?
It seemed like hours. And in reality, it may have been 20 or 30 minutes. But yeah, it seemed like an eternity almost. Like, and not someplace I wanted to leave necessarily.
I mean, do you think that in some way, shape, or form, and maybe this is like something that monks can do, right? Like the really, I don't know how you classify that, the high-end monks, high-end is not the term, but you know, the monks that are really good at what they do and they can essentially just sit for, you probably know this better than I do, they'll sit there for a long, very long amount of time. They won't move or speak or eat or drink. Do you know if there's been some kind of documentation as far as a monk that's done it for X amount of time and that to most of us that would be a crazy amount of time to do such a meditation?
It's very common. Yeah, the monks, especially the, you know, the ones that have been practicing for a while, do develop the ability to levitate and to leave your body, astral project, experience all these other dimensions. It's well documented in Tibetan Buddhism.
Now, Glenn, what about the use of other aids? Have you ever utilized things like peyote, DMT, or ayahuasca to help you get to these different places or connect with beings, anything like that?
No, I've never tried any of those things. I've studied them because a lot of shamans do use them. So I know quite a bit about them, all the ethnobotany that's related to shamanism, like Maria Sabina, for instance, in Mexico with the psilocybin mushroom. But yeah, in Tibetan Buddhism and Hinduism and the various types of Kundalini yoga, I mean, you can do all these things without those substances if you just train yourself to using breath control and sound and you know, these other ancient techniques.
Now, considering the gift that you have, this incredible gift of less than an hour, you're a professional drummer. You've been on stage with some incredible people, and you're very humble because you won't even name drop that much, and I bet you can name drop some amazing bands that you've been a part of and played for. But with your gift, it seems like you already are set up a little bit, or a lot of bit, I should say, ahead of most people. As a drummer, to be able to memorize an entire album and get on stage and play live, mind you, folks, for some of the top musicians in the entire world, I would say that you're head and shoulders above most people in some way, shape, or form that we don't understand, right? I don't know if anyone's ever done a study of your brain and why you're able to be able, or why you are able to execute such things in such a short amount of time. But I would say that people that choose to, maybe they've tried some of these techniques that you've mentioned and it hasn't worked for them as far as being able to go to other dimensions and remote view and astral project and all of these things that you've been talking about. Maybe that's why you've never needed to tap into that side of your brain using these other methods. I mean, essentially drugs, right? I mean, have you thought about that? You're just like, well, maybe I am unlimited, as my friend said. I don't need that stuff.
Well, yeah, I have thought about that. And I think because I became interested in music at a young age and studied piano, and you know, you learn the work. It works both hemispheres of your brain, and they found that the CAT scan done once, and there's a part of your brain that it's basically what they call a brain's brain, and it's thicker on people that kind of have my experiences or are musicians or in that line of work. So I think it's definitely helped that. Plus, ever since I was young, I started trying to train my brain and my body and my physiology, like being able to slow my breathing down to where I could stay underwater for 3 or 4 minutes, or to be able to completely block out pain, things like that. And I've really, I think I probably am predisposed, but I've really worked at studying it, you know, and practicing.
You can stay underwater for 3 or 4 minutes?
Probably not anymore. But yeah, before COVID, I probably could still do that. Yeah.
Man, SEAL Team needs to be getting in touch with you. That's all I know.
Yeah, I would practice. Ever since I was a kid, I would just go underwater and lay on the bottom of the pool and meditate for as long as I could. Hang out and look at the clock, see how long it had been.
Well, what's next on our list here, Glenn? What would you like to cover next?
Well, I guess maybe this kind of ties into a little bit about what we were talking about as far as learning to control my physiology with drumming and meditation. And this also kind of ties into, I've been thinking about, why me? Why was I taken as a child, and why have I had these experiences? And I'd heard something on one of your podcasts where somebody was talking about their father, and it got me thinking about my father. I was adopted, so I don't know my biological father, but the father that adopted me, he was a very, very mean person, and he was an engineer, and he, what he did for a living was he built lakes in Kentucky, and Kentucky used to be known as the Lakeless State, but now we have lots and lots of lakes, and he designed most all of them. And in the process of building these lakes, they destroyed hundreds of burial mounds, hundreds of Native American cemeteries, hundreds of pioneer cemeteries. Sometimes they flooded whole towns. So I'm just thinking, that's got to be some really bad karma. And I always wondered, like, ever since I was a little kid, he would beat me. Some of my earliest memories, 2 or 3 years old, are him beating me. He's just an angry, angry person. And so at a young age, I learned I had to be able to not feel pain, you know, to train my body to not feel pain. So I would actually leave my body in these times just to be able to endure the physicality of it. So I think that had a lot to do with kind of showing me what I was capable of in a very young age and continued into my years.
It's pretty terrible to have to be forced to create a space like that where you're safe and you don't feel pain.
It was so bad. I would come home from school, and whenever it was time for my dad to come home from work, I would go climb the tallest tree I could find, and I would stay out there until way after dark in the tree. Sometimes he'd try to get me down or whatever, but he never could. And it'd be way after dark, and my mom would come out and be like, okay, he's gone to bed, you can come in now. About the same time, I was diagnosed with PTSD because of those experiences.
Oh, geez, Glenn. I absolutely hate to hear stories like that. Like, what in the world did you do to deserve any of that?
It's made me a better person. You know, it's shown me how not to act, and how, you know, it's really impressed on me the need to evolve, be better than the last, you know, the last generation.
Yeah, how not to be a human.
Exactly.
Yeah, where are we going next, Glenn?
Okay. I guess we could talk about my haunted house that I used to live in. It's Berea, Kentucky. And in this town is ancient Native American ceremonial site. They call it Indian Fort Mountain. And it's an old Adena Hopewell Fort Ancient site that I actually helped excavate with the university. And when the excavations were being done, a giant skeleton was found in a grave on top of this mountain, and it had it was 8 feet tall, had a copper skull cap and three copper breastplates, hammered copper, all around the ceremonial site. There are earthworks that I'm the one that's discovered them and surveyed them. So it was a huge ceremonial complex, and the trails all came from all directions into this part of the country. And if you look at it on like a ley line map, it's what would be called a vortex. So it's a really powerful spot. And it seems to draw artistic people. It's a arts and crafts community. So I lived on a house in this town, right on the main Native American trail that goes through there. It's the same trail that passes through where I live now, and it's the trail that Daniel Boone used when he was exploring Kentucky. So I lived right on this trail, and the house I lived in was next door to the house where I lived in high school, where I had the demon appear on the ceiling. So later in life, after I'd come back off the road, I ended up buying the house next door too. Was living there at the time with a band, and we were writing and recording a record. I converted the living room into a studio. Would spend pretty much 24/7 working on our music. And this house, it was built, the side of it is the original, was the like the original gas station, post office, diner there in the town. And then the guy built a house over top of it. Then he passed away before I bought it. This house, my whole band is there, and we would play late into the night, and then we would all take a break and go into the kitchen and drink coffee and talk about what we were going to do next. And more than once, sitting there in the kitchen, we would feel just like a really, really cold, chilly breeze around us, and this strong sulfur smell. And this probably happened two or three times, different nights. And then one of those nights, while we were sitting there discussing how we were all chilled, the hanging plant in the window just started swaying back and forth by itself. So then that's when we kind of figured, well, we've got a ghost here. So one night we were sleeping. The way the house was set up, there was four bedrooms that surrounded a central kitchen. So we're all asleep in our respective bedrooms, and I wake up and I hear somebody in the kitchen. Sounds like they're cooking breakfast. So I'm like, all right, great. Ralph's in there cooking breakfast. As soon as I hear it get quiet, like the food's all done, I'll get up and go in there and eat. So at the same time, Ralph's in his bed thinking, all right, Glenn's in the kitchen cooking breakfast. I'm going to lay here until it's done, and then I'm going to go in there and get some food. So basically, we all are laying in our beds thinking the same thing until we hear the plates set on the table and the silverware set on the table for four. And at the same time, we all get up and walk in there, and the kitchen is completely empty. Nobody.
Yeah, it's a shame there wasn't actual food there. That would be the best kind of ghost.
That would have been the best. We were so hungry.
Especially when you're laying there, you just think, oh, my buddy's making me some food. And then you get up to the horror that there is no food.
I know. And we were starving artists at the time. We were lucky if we ate one meal a day. We were so hungry that one week we would eat just spaghetti noodles. Next week, just potatoes. The next week, just water. Just like we were so hungry, our guitar player would eat in his sleep. He would lay there and we'd go, Jeff, would you like some fried chicken? He'd go,
Oh, my gosh. Okay, was there any smells associated with that experience for any of you guys?
Not the cooking, no. Just the weird sleeper smell.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of classic haunting stuff, but considering the fact that you've got these native ceremonial sites and burial sites, that could be any number of things, including and up to just an old owner, right? Just in a loop in the kitchen.
Be any number of things. And there were more very strange things. Like when I lived in this house, I would have people from all over the world come to visit me from Europe on their holidays or whatever. They get like a month off and they would come hang out with me. And so I'd have visitors all the time. And every single one of them would come to me in the morning and say, "Did you come in my room last night?" I'd be like, "No, why?" "I saw a shadow person standing over in the corner of the room just staring at me when I woke up." And that's probably, I don't know, 10 different people have told me that. I never saw it, but once when my son was a baby, he was about 4 months old, I guess, and I was holding him, and all of a sudden he started looking up in the corner of the room and smiling and laughing and giggling and trying to reach out and grab something, and all the hairs on my arms and the back of my neck just stood up. It was so scary. He saw something, and I believe that little kids, especially babies, can see more things than we can sometimes. It's because they have been told that, you know, no, that's not real.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at HereYouAreAZ.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, yeah, and I'm sorry to go back, but, you know, just you mentioned the importance of not disrupting native burial sites and ceremonial sites, and that's all that your very abusive adoptive father would do. Was he, and you were very young when this is going on, so maybe you wouldn't know, but I wonder if he was always like that, if he was always that violent and angry, or if it's as you say, you start messing with this stuff, that's got to be some bad karma.
No, he wasn't always like that. It wasn't until he my parents were already married. My mother was already out of school and helping to put him through his last year of school. And she said he was a completely different person but once he started that job, he changed and, yeah, just became really, really mean and unhappy. And I mean, it was literally every day wondering, is this the day I'm, you know, is he going to catch me today or am I going to get away? But yeah. And then for me to grow up and be an archaeologist and a protector of burial mounds and native sites, the complete opposite. He used to take me on the job site when I was a little kid. I have home movies of me being 3, 4, 5 years old on these sites where they were just destroying these mounds with heavy machinery. And he'd walk out there and pick up artifacts and stuff and put them in his pocket and keep them, you know.
I mean, as you grew older, did you just never really talk to him? Did he ever change? Did he ever apologize for how he treated you?
As an adult, well, I left home. I guess I was probably beginning of 9th grade. I left to get away from him. But as an adult, I came back. I'd been on, I guess it was my first national tour. I was about 19, just got off the road. I think I'd done 727 shows in 1 year, sometimes 2 or 3 a day, all over the United States. So I had a lot of time to think about it. So I came back and I tried to talk to him about it, you know, ask him why, you know, and he just totally denied that it ever happened. And periodically over the years, I've tried to reconnect with him, even though he treated me the way he treated me. I forgave him and was willing to have a dad in my life. I missed having a dad. But he just right up till the end just denies and denied and just wouldn't. And the last time I talked to him, I said, I love you, Dad. Do you love me? He said, well, I used to when you were a little kid, but not anymore. I said, all right, well.
Wow.
It's been nice knowing you.
That's nice. So he says he used to love you during the times that he actually gave you PTSD from these occurrences. Right. He's saying that's when he used to love you?
It was love.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's a special kind of love that no one deserves to be on the receiving end of.
He was a very misguided soul.
Yes. Well, yeah, sorry for the digression, but that popped in my head, and that should have popped in while we were on the subject, because you blatantly mentioned, like, he was messing with ancient sites, which seems to be a recipe for disaster for many a folk, and the worst part is they know they're doing it.
Agree, and then to bring me out there and to bring home, you know, artifacts from these graves, it was just wrong. So besides the shadow people, the shadow guy that they would see in the house, I used to do music therapy for disabled kids, deaf kids, blind kids. And there'd be like maybe 10 at a time, ranging from, you know, 6 years old. I think the oldest one was, he was probably close to 70, and he was blind. But I would do music therapy with these kids and these people at my house once a week. It was really cool because, especially for like a little deaf girl that's never heard music, to see her hold the drum, play it, and feel the vibration, and special. I was working actually with that little deaf girl. The older guy, the blind guy, he was trying to cause some problems. Like, he got this look on his face I'd never seen. And the lady that brought him there, social worker, had never seen it either. It's like his eyes rolled back in his head, and he got this really mean look on his face, and he shoved that little blind girl. And as soon as he did that, I had my teacup sitting on the the end table beside me. As soon as he shoved that little girl, that teacup went flying across the room at his head and broke on the, there was a stone wall inside the house, break right beside him. Music therapy was over for that day, and they didn't come back. That scared us all.
What did the social worker say about that?
She said it was a poltergeist, which I'd never heard of before. I'd heard of the movie, but I didn't know what a poltergeist was. She said that's, she knew what it was. Apparently she said it's a poltergeist. I still don't know what a poltergeist is, really. Do you know?
Well, the term for it translated is noisy ghost, usually. So they're famous for moving things and making noises, walking around the house, things like that. But yeah, it's translated as noisy ghost.
Well, that makes sense because it's sitting up against the wall and smashed it.
Well, and it's obviously a well-meaning noisy ghost that you had because it did not like this jerky man shoving the little girl.
It didn't like them at all.
And it's, you know, the guy is probably lucky that either A, it just wanted to scare him, or B, that it had bad aim. Because it was towards his head, but not at it, like right at his head, right?
He was lucky, yes. Yeah. He was a strange guy. He would, where he lived, he would go out into the woods behind the house and take Walmart bags and weave them together into some kind of weird little tent structure and just sit out there.
A bunch of Walmart bags big enough for him to get into?
No, he would take them and like kind of pile them and weave them together into like this one big sheet of Walmart bags.
Oh, gosh.
And he made like this little tent shelter in the woods.
Oh, goodness. See, you just never know who's in the woods. You got to be careful. You just do not know. And obviously, he's blind to most of us, but in some instances, he's not blind at all. So that's very strange.
Strange.
Well, yeah, what else went down in that house?
That's probably the only other kind of ghost type stuff besides just the general negative energy of that house. It just had a bad feel to it. It was constantly burning sage and cleansing it. Yeah, I sold it and bought a place on an island in Belize.
Do you know how old that house was, Glenn?
Yeah, let's see. The original, like it was the original, you know, little kind of trading post for on this trail. So that original structure was probably, you know, late 1800s, I'm guessing, mid 1800s. And it had been built over a few times.
Right, and I wonder what these various structures, their purpose was, right? Who knows?
Yeah, there was one, the weirdest thing in that house was there was a basement door that you opened and it just went into like this little room with like a concrete bench and that's all it was.
Oh, that's creepy.
I don't know what it was.
That's a little creepy. Yeah,
it was a creepy place.
I've heard of that several times on the show where someone moves into a place and then they're in the basement and they're like, oh, it looks like a door or maybe it's like a faux wall or something, right? And then they get back in there and it's just this tiny little room for God knows what and you probably don't want to ever know.
Yeah, it's really strange.
Well, yeah, where are we going next?
To talk about the UFO, they're still here. It was actually clear last night. It's been kind of raining, so I haven't been able to see them. But last night, or actually early this morning, I'm up at 3, and I look out. And occasionally over the last month, I would look outside or my wife would look outside and we're on top of a mountain. And then you look over this valley and then probably the next mountain is maybe 20 miles away. And you could see on the horizon, I thought it was a forest fire at first, just this orange, it looked like a fire, just, and then it just disappeared below the horizon. It just completely went away. And she said she looked out once and saw it. What I saw this morning, I finally saw what was making the light. It's a triangle craft, and it's just orange, fiery orange, and it's huge. And I saw it this morning and figured out, well, that's the source of this light, because like when she said she saw it, she saw it. She said, is there a city over there or town over there? Look at all those lights. And it had lit up that whole mountainside. And today I saw it. And this morning I was like thinking, you know, like I'm going to communicate with them. I'm like, are you what I've been seeing? That's, I thought was a forest fire lighting up the whole mountain. And they slowly moved up about 100 feet and stopped. So I just thought a few more things, and they responded every time. And they were there for probably a good 2 hours. I even got my telescope out and went out to look at it. And I could see it with my naked eye. And anytime I tried to look at it through the telescope, I couldn't find it. I was out there for a half hour and it was driving me crazy. I'm like, I can see you right there with my naked eye. And then I'm trying to find you on the telescope and nothing. So frustrating. I finally gave up. It's like, well, I see you and you know I'm here. Well, I was like, do you know I'm here? And they moved again. They flew up about another 100, 200 feet, stopped and hovered.
Well, if all of that isn't a proponent and an argument for this being tied into consciousness, and I don't know what is, right?
It's pretty obvious to me. You know, there were a few helicopters flying in the vicinity of it, like checking it out, probably from the military base that's not too far from there. And this military base, it's has extensive underground facilities too. And it's just everybody knows that lives around here that's what's going on there.
Those helicopter pilots, if they're not the same ones, which hopefully they aren't, because boy, they need to get a different post. I mean, haven't they learned by now not to mess with those things? You told the story last time of one of them, you know, dropping 100 or so feet and they're trying to mess with these UFOs. I have a question for you, and it's just conjecture on your part, of course. Why do you think UFOs even have lights? Do you think it's part of their propulsion? Do they have them for when they need to draw attention to themselves? What's the point?
I have no idea. I've never even thought about it. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, because it's, you know, different theories out there that it is tied to their propulsion. But you do hear of people. I think I brought E-SETI up to you last time as well, but I've talked about E-SETI Ranch before in Washington State. But, you know, the power-ups, the quote-unquote power-ups, and they're telling the craft, oh, communicate with me with your lights, and, you know, yes and no, and power up and get brighter for a yes, or whatever it was. And that's what these things would do. So you kind of go, well, is it for both? Is it for communication and propulsion? Or, I mean, because other than that, if you have something that can zoom through folded time or whatever the heck they can do to get here, why in the world would they need the parking lights? You know, the old white reverse lights. I don't think they really need those, but we're guessing about something that we just is way far beyond our comprehension.
That's true. I mean, and why would they light up the whole top of a mountain like that?
Yeah.
On multiple occasions.
Yeah, and that's cool because we've heard of UFOs that will shoot essentially, quote unquote, a beam of light, right? Like it looks like it's zapping something very specifically. And then in your case, it lights up an entire mountain.
And before that, it zapped that large military helicopter.
Yes.
And all these other helicopters that are smaller, they stay way far away from it. I mean, they're within, you know, sight of it, but they never get that close anymore.
They learned their lesson. Yes, they did. Sometimes we're smart enough to stay out of our own way. Oh, yeah. Okay, so you just talked about recent UFO stuff, like last night. You also mentioned in your email two very recent Bigfoot vocalizations and some missing goats.
Behind my house, and there's I've got 40 acres here, and then it's connected to Daniel Boone National Forest. And then across this little section of National Forest, there's a goat farm, and it's behind me, maybe a mile behind me or something. One night I was in the kitchen and I had the window open. It was in the summertime, and I heard this super loud roar coming from down in the woods in that direction. So loud. And then after that, a dog would bark. And then maybe 5 seconds later, it did the same roar. And then the dog would bark. And it kept doing that. And it did it like 5 or 6 times. It obviously wasn't any animal that I've heard around here. So I went online and was looking up sounds of Bigfoot, and I found a couple that had recorded, I think it was in, it's either Canada or Colorado, maybe in Canada, but they had two of them, and they had like a little baby, and they were maybe camping or something, and it was the same noise that I heard, and it did it about the same amount of times, but it was exactly the same. So I was like, well, that was a Bigfoot. So the next time I see these goat farmers, I'm going to ask them if they're missing any goats. So unfortunately, the next time I saw them, the goats were in my garden eating everything I'd grown this summer.
Oh,
yeah, there's like 20 of them in there. So I went and talk to them, and they don't believe in fencing their goats in, so they just let them run wild. I said, well, you probably lose a lot of goats that way. And they said, oh yeah, we've lost 4 adults and 2 kids in the last year. I said, well, you know, there's some big predators around here. They didn't want to say Bigfoot. Yeah, I heard a Bigfoot down in your goat farm taking their goats.
You're like, by the way.
Like, yeah, we have big predators around here. We have black bear. We have wildcats. And
you're like coughing. You're like, Bigfoot. I'm sorry. I had something in my throat.
And he pointed over to his dog like, well, I'm not worried. I've got this dog. And I was just thinking, yeah, good luck with that. So the goats are disappearing quickly, and it sounds like a Bigfoot buffet down there.
I mean, with them not being fenced in, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, it could just be them kind of wandering off, and then maybe they wandered into the wrong garden, and somebody either kept them or, you know, shot them or something.
Well, they all stay together. They all follow this one, the goat king, I guess, So that's why they travel like 20. They'll be in a herd, and like in my garden or walking down the road, they're always together. And I told the guy, I said, you know, the neighbors have mentioned that they almost hit your goat. Has anybody killed any of your goats? No, no problems. And so I told him he probably should. I said, good fences make good neighbors, and some neighbors make good goats too. So there's an option there.
Yeah.
Fence them in, or they're going to start disappearing. So it could just be nobody around here would do that. People live and let live. You know, they're not going to even let, I couldn't have killed their goats. You know, I could have shot at them or whatever, but I just told them, hey, you know, we're neighborly people here, and just want to let you, give you a heads up, you know. So I think they disappeared from what we heard down there
You're like, by the way, your goats are well fed now, so you're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, she offered to reimburse me for my garden. Aww. So now how are you going to do that?
You're gonna replant and come here every day and tend to it? I don't know. Yeah, and bringing up that dog, I mean, the dog's going to be on the porch or underneath the porch urinating itself when the biggies come through. So you're like, yeah, the quote-unquote other predators in the area, dog's not going to do much with that. He's going to know. He's going to be a whole lot smarter, and he's gonna turn tail and be out of there.
I wanted to say, have you ever seen a video of a black bear and a dog? Or just imagine a Bigfoot and a dog. From all the stories that you've heard, they don't get along.
Mm-mm. Usually. No, and I think there are some dogs, and they're probably smaller dogs, because let's face it, they have little man syndrome. I have a small dog, and he's just as dumb as the rest of the small dogs. God bless small dogs, okay, everybody? We know that this is how they are. They don't know when to turn tail. Like, the bigger dogs are like, I'm out. I'm smart enough to know. This is not my fight, okay? Another day, another time, in another life, when maybe I'm a small dog and I decide to do this this ill-advised thing.
It's true. I used to have a Chihuahua in Belize, and she was fearless.
Yeah, they are. They really are. And maybe they're not. I shouldn't say stupid. That's probably the wrong thing to do to say about these dogs. But, you do question their judgment at the very least. And bravery and stupidity can be a fine line, I think, sometimes. But yeah, most small dogs are very much like that. Well, they used a small dog in Harry and the Hendersons, right? Wasn't it like a Jack Russell Terry or something? And it was just torturing Harry and barking his head off at Harry until Harry finally decided to show him, hey, look, I can crush you like a little bug if I want to.
I wanted to tell you about some of the cattle mutilations that we found on our farm. When I was growing up, we had a family farm in Western Kentucky, and it was about 5,000 acres, cattle ranch and corn and soybeans, and huge, huge farm. And it actually bordered George Washington's farm. The same county. When we were talking before, I said something about no coyotes being in Kentucky, and I misspoke. What I meant to say was no coyotes in Eastern Kentucky at the time. Like, they were hunted. We killed them all out in the 70s and 80s, because around here you have smaller farms. You just get rid of the predators, and that's what happened. In Western Kentucky, like on our 5,000 acre farm, plenty of room for coyotes. There's no way you could have eradicated them all. And we tried. We would actually camp out at night on the roof of the barn with our 30-30s and, try to shoot as many as we could, because they would try to get the young pigs that were in the barn. So if we didn't do that, whole packs of them would just go in there and rip the baby pigs to shreds. But many times when we were just out looking for stray cows or whatever, we had dirt bikes that we rode around and cowboyed on. Many times we would come across a dead cow, freshly killed, no blood, pieces of the cow missing. Like around the mouth and the backside all the time. I mean, we had, I don't know, thousand head or something. Yeah, so we would find them quite often, like at least three or four a summer. And there would also be these black helicopters and really low flying jets that would just part the trees occasionally. But we were kids. We didn't know what a cattle mutilation was. I mean, we just took note. Well, okay, we got to tell granddad there's a dead cow, and the East Pasture, you know. But as I got older and started hearing about cattle mutilations and seeing the pictures and what was going on, I was like, oh yeah, we saw that all the time.
I mean, do you remember those times and you seeing UFOs in the sky? Besides, you know, you got this, I mean, low-flying jets enough to part the trees. I can see that, and that's pretty incredible. That's really, really low. And then black helicopters. Besides that stuff flying around, did you see anything, any strange craft?
Never. It was weird. It was, this property was between two major Air Force bases, right in the middle. No, I never saw any strange lights out there, any UFOs or anything like that. Just the jets and the helicopters occasionally.
Mm. And all the cattle, the three or four a summer, would all be mutilated in the same manner?
Not exactly the same. Like I said, we were kids. We just figured, well, something killed one of the cows. You know, just thought it was strange why. Why did they, you know, there's no blood around it. And why did they just take the mouth and the backside?
I'll have to get into my Stalking the Herd, Christopher O'Brien book, and see in that area if he had ever been out in that area to investigate. Around what year or years would this be, I should say?
Have been in the 70s, like all through the 70s.
Yeah, I'm gonna look that up.
It was Grayson County. It's northwestern Kentucky.
Grayson County, okay. Because even if he hasn't been out there, I've always called it the Cattle Mute Bible, because it is. I mean, it's incredible volume. I'm gonna look that up and see if, even if he hasn't been out there, he would probably have documented that area if he had heard about it. So I would look that up. That's pretty interesting. Well, yeah, where are we going next, Glenn?
Yeah, so Kentucky used to have more burial mounds than any other state. I think now probably Ohio does, because most of the ones here were plowed over for agriculture, tobacco fields, and that kind of stuff. But there are quite a few left. Especially right here close to where I live, there's a lot. Strange things have happened to a couple of my friends, another guy that I've been in bands with on and off with all my life. He likes to go out, him and our other friend, they like to go out at night, explore these old burial mounds. And I'm like, why can't we go? Hey guys, come on, Glenn, let's go. No, it's all right. I don't want to go at night. Let's go in the daytime. And then after they told me what's been happening to them, I'm like, see? So they've been paced out of the woods, chased out of the woods on two occasions by Bigfoot in the same area. And once before, the guitar player friend of mine was there with another guy, and they were also chased out of the woods. Now, to get to this mound, they had to climb over like an 8-foot chain link fence. Hard to get to. But evidently, when this Bigfoot roared at them and started chasing them, they didn't have any problem with that fence. That's just one of the times that they've had Bigfoot experiences at those mounds. They've told me some other experiences, and I actually recorded them because I thought they were really interesting. But when I went back to listen to them, the recording was really messed up. You couldn't understand what was, but all I remember, the main part, was that at one point he fell asleep on this burial mound and woke up, and there was a Bigfoot standing over him with his face right in front of his face. He said he rolled over and rolled down the mound and then took off running, like jumped that fence and got the heck out of there.
the 8-foot fence suddenly turns into a 1-foot fence real quick in your mind. You're like, I'm over here. I am out.
A hurdle.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hurdle. You grow some long legs in that situation. So these mounds are confirmed Native American burial mounds, or what? You know, what's the confirmation on that? It is?
Yeah.
So
I work with a couple of the universities around here doing the archaeology and surveying of a lot of these mounds. And the guy that was in charge passed away recently, but he left me all his files and all his research. And so, yeah, I have locations to all these different places. And there's actually a place really close to me that I'm going to go. I'm going to try to go there tomorrow, actually. It's called Bone Hollow. And the reason why it's called that is because in the 1600s, I guess a ship landed in Virginia and had smallpox on board, and eventually made it to the Native American population here. And a few of the tribes all got sick, and they all ended up in this one hollow and died. So there was hundreds and hundreds of dead Indians in this, on this creek and on these hillsides of this hollow. And they call it Bone Hollow. And the really messed up thing is in the early 1800s, when the first settlers settled and took over that property, And it's basically what they did here. Like my great grandfather and his wife was Cherokee. He said they basically just came in, and if they wanted the place, they just took it by force, you know, took your property. So that's basically what they did, took over this burial ground, and their farm was on top of the hill, and they would take wagons down to that creek and that hollow. And they would load up the bones, because there were so many bones, they were just on the surface. They would load wagon fulls of bones and take them up to their farm and burn them in their pastures for fertilizer.
Oh, gosh.
So I'm thinking that's going to be an interesting place to go.
Yeah.
Go check out.
I would say
it's,
so.
It's something that nobody really knows about. It's.
I mean, to have a Bigfoot in your face, right? You don't hear that a whole lot. I mean, like, your experience from last time was you saw one within 3 feet, which is extremely close. Do not get me wrong, but you don't hear a whole lot about them literally in your face. And this one seemed like it was pretty pissed that your friends were in this burial mound area. Now, considering the fact that they had an 8-foot fence they had to jump over, where my brain goes is that this is a protected area. It's closed off, which means that the Bigfoot are used to the fact that it's closed off, probably save for, you know, a few people tending to the area, whatever they need to do to keep that area up and keep it safe, right? They're probably there just during the day. And then you have these guys hopping the fence and being in that area. So the Bigfoot are going, what the hell are you doing in this spot? Get out. Or is there a thought that, and I know there are some people of the mind, that they would care that there's these burial mounds there and there's some tie-in there somewhere. What are your thoughts on that?
Definitely think they probably were shocked that they were in there at night, because they shouldn't have been there. And they probably weren't used to, you know, like you say, they're used to the occasional researcher in the daytime, but not at night. I don't know. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of mystery around the burial mounds. You know, they're usually credited to the Adena people and then later Hopewell people. But a lot of the Adena, a lot of the natives, when the first Europeans came, they said, you know, they were way before us or our ancestors. Some people think because of
hundreds of giant skeletons that have been found in these mounds, that they could be giants. They could be, some people think maybe they could be Bigfoot skeletons sometimes. I don't know. It's very curious to me, and the whole idea of them protecting these mounds, these burial areas, it intrigued me because that when the first experience they had around other, you know, they had other experiences at other burial mounds also.
I mean, how many I told you so's did you say to your friends after hearing this story?
I couldn't resist.
No, how could you? Especially after a Bigfoot right in his face. That's a huge, yeah, I told you so.
There's been so many times when I've been like, it's a beautiful day, let's go explore these places. And he's a night guy. He's like, well, all right. And then by the time he calls me, you know, it's already dark. I'm like, dude, I'm getting ready for bed. We're going out. I wouldn't do that if I was you.
Was this before or after that incident?
This was before.
Yeah. You're like, I don't hear from him now about going out at night. Darndest thing. I can't figure out why.
I'm trying to call him for a couple of weeks and can't get in touch with him. So I don't know what's going on.
Is that strange?
It is strange. Yeah. But he's a strange guy. So I'm just going to chalk it up to that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he didn't pick another mound to go just chill out on in the middle of the night. With a slightly too tall of a fence that he couldn't get over in time, right? So, well, Glenn, I really appreciate you coming back on.
Until the next, the home of rock and roll.
I think I'm going to close with that. I think I'm going to leave that in the recording. And I'm gonna, and then Alan Watts is going to come in with Electus. I think I'm going to leave that in. Because it'll be an inside joke for you and I. Everyone else is going, why is he quoting Rain Man? Like, that was our audio test, okay, guys? Just zip it up. It's right. None of your business. Yeah. 97X. Well, thanks, Glenn. Have a good day out there.
Well, I'm so-and-so. I was given this name by my parents. I've been to such and such a college. I've done these things in my profession. I produce a little biography. The Buddha says, forget it. That's not true. That's some story. That's all gone. That's all past. I want to see the real you you are now. Well, nobody knows who that is. Because we don't know ourselves except through listening to our echoes and consulting our memories. But then there's a real you, and that again leads us back to this question. Who are you? That is the real you. We shall see how they play with this exam. By the koans, to get you to come out of your shell and find out who you really are. suddenly become somebody different, living somewhere else. They will say reincarnation means this, that if you sitting here now are really convinced that you're the same person who walked in at the door half an hour ago, you're being reincarnated. If you are liberated, you understand that you're not. The past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist. There is only the present. That's the only real you that there is. The Zen master Dogen put it in this way. He said, spring does not become the summer. First there is summer, and then there is spring.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.